Legislative priorities, the truth about the gold trade, and being LGBTQ during the pandemic. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Lawmakers are in Tallahassee for the next couple of months battling over bills. We're going to take a look at a couple focused on minimum wage and medical marijuana. Also, the new book, Dirty Gold, from Miami Herald Reporters, explores how drug traffickers are using gold to launder their money and how it all plays out here in Miami. And so many people are struggling with the solitude of the pandemic. LGBTQ teens may be experiencing even greater anxiety.
Finding the people that are going to support and uplift you is going to really give you that sense of validation, especially if you're a young queer person.
Finally, an art exhibit that challenges our understanding of mental health. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Well, the legislative session is underway in Tallahassee. Today, let's look at a few controversial bills that are on the docket. There's a bill to circumvent the amendment of raising the minimum wage. There's another that lowers the chemical in marijuana that makes you high. And there's also a bill to protect businesses from COVID liability. So much to talk about. Well, joining us now to discuss these is Christine Sexton with the News Service of Florida in Tallahassee. Christine, great to have you on the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Christine, what appears to be the key priorities for DeSantis right now in this session?
Sure. Well, the governor is going to be running for, this is an important session because he's going to be running for a second term as governor in 2022. So this session is all about making the Republican base happy. So that means cracking down on big tech, combating China's influence in state universities, pursuing, quote, anti-mob legislation, and other issues that are important to the Republican base.
So let's talk about some of these. We recently spoke with lawmakers, Democratic State Senator Perry Thurston and Republican State Representative Chip LaMarca about the COVID liability bill. There appears to be a huge divide across party lines. Does the bill appear to have enough support to pass?
You know, this is, yes, but this is a complicated issue and the devil is in the details here. I think lawmakers actually on both sides of the aisle have concerns to offer lawsuit protections for healthcare providers and general businesses, but it's how do you do that? How far do you go? And I think ultimately they have the votes, but the devil is in the details on this one.
Hmm. And again, this is to protect businesses from lawsuits if someone were to get COVID at a particular business. We also talked about that with nursing homes recently. Talking about finances, Floridians overwhelmingly supported raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. That's over the next 5 years. But Republican lawmakers are trying to find a way to make adjustments. What's being proposed?
Yes. So the legislature is, well, two lawmakers have filed what they call joint resolutions. And that's essentially the equivalent of a constitutional amendment. They can go straight, if they're passed, they can go straight to the ballot. And what the legislature, what these joint resolutions are proposing is that lawmakers be able to revisit the minimum wage amendment that was passed by voters last year, and to carve certain groups of people out from those payments. And just to remind people, so in September of this year, it goes up to $10 an hour, and then it's going to increase by $1 an hour every year until it reaches $15 in 2026. What lawmakers are saying is people under the age of 21, convicted felons and other, quote, hard-to-hire people should be able to be carved out from underneath that. And
we've seen this
proposal filed in the House and Senate to do that.
We've seen this before when voters voted to allow felons to vote once they have paid their time. You know, that, of course, Republicans passed an amendment or passed bills saying, well, yes, but then you have to pay your fees. They found a way to circumvent the voters' desires, right?
Yeah, but this one's a little trickier. So in order for this one to pass, they actually would need to put this, so this is a joint resolution, and that means it needs to pass the each chamber, the House and the Senate, by 3/5 vote, not just a simple majority. And they cannot carve these groups of people out without voters weighing in on it, right? So if these bills pass, it allows these issues to be brought back in front of the voters. And voters would essentially be asked to weigh in on whether or not they want to give lawmakers the ability to carve these people out.
Yeah.
So it's not quite the same as what they did with Fallon voting, but yes, the legislature often is accused of, and they often do, you know, revisit issues that lawmakers, that voters pass.
Yeah, and thank you for the clarification on that. I want to move over to another big one. There's a push now to limit the amount of THC that can be in medical marijuana. Again, this is the chemical that gives you that sense of being high. What's the argument by Representative Spencer Roach and Ray Rodriguez for this kind of cap?
Well, you know, they fear that without the cap, you know, it can cause psychotic behavior. And this has been a real fight in the past, but you've had a Florida Senate that's been willing to, you know, refuse to take it up. But this year, it's different. You have sentiment in the Florida Senate to place some caps on these products. So this has caused quite the buzz at the Capitol.
And, of course, advocates for medical marijuana are saying that one of the arguments they make is it'll push costs up for people.
Yeah, because right now the argument is that if you place a 10% cap on smokable marijuana, you'll have to, you know, smoke more pot, smoke more flower to get what you're able to get today. And again, the THC levels in other medical marijuana products, they're considering capping that at about 16%, excluding edibles. But the Senate president told reporters that he thinks that, quote, we have a lot of senators that would support an idea like that. And this is, like I said, the House, you've got leadership that supports this, but the Senate in the past has always been willing to say no. And after this election, you've got senators who are now willing to support something like this.
And the other thing, too, is you said the governor wants to keep people happy since he's preparing for another run. You know what? This was overwhelming. This medical marijuana legalization was overwhelmingly supported by Floridians, even Republicans. So could there be pushback if the governor signs that?
Well, you know, I have to say that we have not. First of all, we have not been able to get that question into the governor yet. He took several questions after his State of the State address yesterday, but I wasn't able to get that one into him. I don't know where the governor stands on this. As you know, the governor was the reason the legislature agreed to revisit what they did initially after voters passed medical marijuana. Remember, initially, the legislature wouldn't let you smoke it.
Yeah.
And DeSantis came in and he said, you know, encouraged the legislature to lift the ban on smoking. You know, the state was getting sued. It was contrary to what voters had passed. And so DeSantis really came in with, you know, a strong position on it.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, it was interesting to see that. And the legislature responded. I don't know how the governor is going to come down on this.
Well, and the State of the State was on Tuesday. We'll all wait and see where the governor stands on this one. We got 2 months of session, so plenty of time. Christine Sexton with the News Service of Florida in Tallahassee. Christine, thanks for the insight.
Oh, thank you for having me.
All right, still to come. How is gold from South America helping drug traffickers launder their money, especially here in Miami? To Sundial on WLRN. You know that the smartphone in your pocket has a little bit of gold in it, right? And some of that gold is mined in South America. So that gold is mined and it makes its way to US and China. The mining industry there is highly unregulated, and mining itself is having devastating repercussions on the environment in South America. The new book, Dirty Gold, from Miami Herald reporters Jay Weaver, Nick Nehemas, Kira Gurney, and Jim Wiss, explores this illegal trade and the critical role that South Florida, especially Miami, plays in this process. And Jay and Nick are with us today. Guys, thank you so much. I always appreciate having you guys on.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You know, I mean, the two of you, Kira and Jim, came out with this multi-part web series back in 2018, Dirty Gold, Clean Cash. I wonder, what was the response after that? Did anything that you hear, was it any surprising? Did you learn anything new, perhaps, from readers?
I think the biggest thing was that the fact that Miami is really the center of this industry in terms of being where all this gold comes into the U.S. was a huge surprise to readers in Miami and around the country. I mean, for instance, one of the biggest gold refineries in the world is located in Opa-locka. I really don't think many people knew about that, much less all the environmental destruction, the enabling of money laundering and drug trafficking, the human rights abuses that happen in South America. There was a huge reaction. We were, very honored to be a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and we had lawmakers, including Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, calling for immediate action.
You know what, Jay, when did you guys know this would be a book?
A good question. let me just back up a little bit. I wasn't even certain of the series that I collaborated on with Nick and Kara and Jim that ran in the paper in January, of 2000.
All right, Jay, I think we lost the connection there. All right, we're going to try to reconnect with Jay. But Nick, I mean, just to continue on what he was saying there, I mean, at what point did you guys decide that it was a big series. It was a 5-part series. But, when did you decide to take it further? Did you have to do more investigation to expand it into a book?
Yeah, I mean, so there was a huge amount of work we had to do to get it into a book, and that process started when an editor from Public Affairs, a publishing house that kind of specializes in finding newspaper investigations and turning them into books, they reached out to us. It had never occurred to us that this could be a book, and they said, this story has everything. I mean, it spans the globe. There's, there's criminals, there's federal agents, there's a business aspect, the American consumer directly plays a role in this and has no idea. So turning it into a book was, really a completely different process from a newspaper series. First and foremost, we had to convince a lot of people to talk for the book so we could develop characters and a narrative, people who were not eager to participate in a newspaper series when there was an ongoing court case.
Jay, this story follows three business partners who went by the nickname the Three Amigos. Who are these three men?
Well, they are three friends in Miami who came to know each other through the go-go real estate years of the 2000 era through the subprime market, and they were mortgage brokers, and they all got to know each other through one of the local HSBC affiliates, and they made a fortune, and then they lost a fortune when the entire real estate market collapsed, and the mortgage business went in the tank. And then they got to know each other again through the for-profit educational business, businesses like Kaplan. And they all became salesmen for that group. And then one of them, a named Samer Baraj, London-born guy, educated, multilingual, came to know a company called NTR Metals that was owned by a company in Dallas called Elemental that invested in and sold gold and on major exchanges. And they were looking to expand into Latin America in 2011 and 12. And so they came to know Sam Abraj through his wife, who worked as an administrative assistant with NTR Metals. And so they hired Samer to open the Latin American operation. And then he subsequently hired Renato Rodriguez, kind of a working-class guy, Ecuadorian background, who was raised in Brooklyn. And he in turn, along with Samer, recruited another guy named Juan Granda, who was a FSU graduate, smart guy, grew up in the Cutler Bay area, and he had worked with them, as I said before, in the subprime business and in the poor education business.
And I'm just curious, Jay, did these three guys, when they came together as business partners, did they go in knowing, intending to do illegal activity, or did they just fall into it?
No, that's a good question. First of all, as you can see, they're all salesmen, and they're all pretty good at what they do, but they had no background in the precious metals business or the gold business. And so slowly but surely, they put their skills, you know, to use and started teaming up with some unsavory characters down in Peru and elsewhere, but mainly Peru, which was really the center of, you know, the gold, the illegal gold mining activity, gold yeah. trading activity. And they came to know this one guy named Peter Ferrari, who, that was an alias, but he had a history of, you know, collaborating with drug traffickers and money launderers and been in the gold business for a long time.
Yeah.
He was a middleman who sold a lot of gold from the Peruvian, you know, mine in the Peruvian rainforest area, the alluvial Andean foothills of the mountains there. And they sold this through, you know, this through Lima, through the exchanges, to NTR Metals, which was based in Miami.
And they
did not start off intending to break the law, but slowly but surely they found themselves doing just that as they became involved in a kind of a, you know, international conspiracy to smuggle gold from Latin America to the United States and
right.
through Miami.
Yeah. And then just real quickly, I got to tell you one of the things, first of all, that I love with this book is you lay out the characters, you lay out the setting, you know, and you've got Peru, Ecuador, and Chile. And then of course, all of this coming back to Florida, not just Florida. You have a couple other places here in the United States, but of course, South Florida, Miami being so central. Nick, these three countries that you focus on, do we know how much gold is coming out of these countries?
Yeah, so Peru is one of the largest gold producers in the world, actually. And it produces, you know, dozens of tons. I think in 2017, the last year that there's really good U.S. data, the U.S. imported 43 tons of gold from Peru. Now, the other countries you mentioned are interesting. Ecuador, Chile, Colombia is a big gold producer, and so is Brazil. But what we found and what the federal agents investigating this case found is that there was a big crackdown in Peru on illegal gold because, you know, people are being poisoned by mercury. People are being forced into sexual slavery. You know, the rainforest is being destroyed. It was an international catastrophe.
Yeah.
So the government acted to crack down, and Peruvian gold, all of a sudden, there were no more exports to the U.S. All of a sudden, Ecuador, Chile, Colombia, exports of gold from these countries exploded. And
yeah.
what was really happening is that it was all Peruvian gold that was being smuggled out of the country. And that's really, you know, the narrative of the book.
Again, I'm talking with the Miami Herald's Nick Nehamas and Jay Weaver. They're part of a team of reporters behind the new book, Dirty Gold, The Rise and Fall of an International Smuggling Ring. Learn more about it, by the way. Just check out our social media, WLRN Sundial. So to get an understanding, Jay, this gold is being smuggled in and it's being used basically to help launder, but I know it's a big process, but how can you, you know, just give me the very brief synopsis here of what these three men were doing, bringing the gold here and how they were basically laundering it for drug traffickers.
Well, eventually the federal authorities in Miami, Homeland Security agents, along with the U.S. Attorney's Office and the DEA and the FBI, all began to collaborate on this long project of focusing on the suspicious spiked imports of gold into Miami. Why Miami? It's the closest to South America. So, you know, the spot price is pretty much, you know, fluctuates every day. But really, the person who gets the gold deal is the person who cuts the deal first. And so NCR Metals really capitalized on their proximity, along with other businesses, gold refiners and brokers in Miami. So the Fed noticed this dramatic uptick in 2013, 14, 15, 16. And so by the time 2017 came around, they were investigating heavily the three amigos, as we called them, at NCR Metals and other gold importers. And they started, you know, developing this case, and they started looking at who was behind it. And they noticed that there were all these phony mines being created as cover for illegally mined gold. They noticed that there were all these middlemen, you know, who had created shell companies with straw owners to disguise who was really the owner. They noticed that, you know, there were payoffs and that there were bribes paid. And they noticed that there were drug traffickers working in the trade, extorting and coercing a lot of these miners, especially the miners are known as artisanal miners,
right,
who are kind of under the coercion of these criminal gangs. So
taken together,
that built the case for a $3.6 billion money laundering investigation.
And I don't want to give away what happens to these men, but here's the other thing, though, Jay, is after that, after the story of those three guys, I mean, really, what has the federal government done to slow this down, or has it?
Well, I mean, briefly, there was an immediate slowdown with the 2017 indictment of these three NCR Metals brokers, and their company also was charged and agreed to, you know, pay a $14 million, $15 million fine, and so it really sent a chill through the industry. And so Latin America became kind of radioactive for importing gold,
yeah,
particularly from Peru and these other areas. But to flash forward 4 years, you know, Nick and I and Jim Wist and Kara Gurney, you know, have come to learn that while Peru cracked down on this area called La Pampa and on these criminal gangs and these rogue groups and all of the devastation there, it quickly spread again to other areas, kind of a whack-a-mole effect.
Yeah.
And with the COVID pandemic, you know, the major conglomerates that run the major mines in Mexico and in South America, they kind of stopped operating. And so there was this creation of an illegal mining network that went beyond where they typically were in the southern Peruvian area. And it has expanded since. And so it's exploding again. And
yeah,
the buyers are not just here. They're all over the world.
Yeah, real briefly, Nick, just in time here. You know, one of the things this book made me think about is, there's the gold in the phone, but just gold that I may own. I don't know where it's coming from. And I get this feeling from your work. I may never know. It's hard to trace gold.
That's absolutely right. I mean, gold can be melted and remelted. You know, there's no way to test it to see where it came from. So, you know, to everyone who's listening right now, I mean, look at your wedding ring, your earrings, your cell phone, your laptop, you know, there is gold in there, and you really don't know where it comes from or who was hurt in the making of it. It's very similar to blood diamonds in that sense. And, you know, there are government crackdowns, there are corporations trying to improve their supply chains, but nothing in this will change unless consumers do what they did with blood diamonds and demand more transparency and accountability in this industry.
It's not, of course, not to make anybody feel bad about what they have, but it is a fascinating book because it makes you think about where this stuff is coming from and how Miami plays a role. Of course it does in all of this. Again, I want to thank Miami Herald's Nick Nehamas and Jay Weaver. They're part of a team of reporters that came out with a new book. It's called Dirty Gold, The Rise and Fall of an International Smuggling Ring. Learn more about it on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Nick, Jay, always a pleasure. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you, Louis.
Thank you.
All right, still to come. LGBTQ students are struggling even more with social isolation during this COVID-19 pandemic. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Being stuck at home during COVID-19 and cut off from social networks can be especially distressing for LGBTQ+ kids, who are already at a greater risk for mental health issues. According to the National Alliance on Mental Health, high school students who identify as lesbian, gay, or bisexual are more than 4 times as likely to have attempted suicide compared to their heterosexual peers. WLRN intern and high school student Saria Reimer spoke with Amanda Cutney. She is the youth program director at the Compass LGBTQ Plus Community Center.
Let's take a moment to sort of establish what your work looked like prior to COVID. What do you do? What's your job?
I oversee all of our youth and family services that we provide to the community. And prior to COVID, that looked like hosting all of our support groups that we had. We have our mental health services, so overseeing that portion. We did a lot of community events for our young people to engage with the larger community. We also did partnerships with other nonprofits and organizations. We did activities like going to bowling or seeing the opera, just, you know, things out in the world, doing community service projects. We have a mentor program with United Way, so we had our mentors come in and we did activities with them. So a lot of, just a variety of things to engage LGBTQ youth and families and adults so that they feel supported in their community and have the resources that they need to ensure that they have a successful life.
Right. That sounds really cool. But then COVID-19 happens. So what do you find was like the biggest challenge when suddenly all of this in-person work is moved online just like that?
It was, you know, anyone's going to say it was really hard, and it really was hard. And it was difficult just as being staff at Compass, but what was the most difficult was knowing how it was affecting the young people we serve. And we were trying to work as fast as we could to make sure that they didn't feel such a drop in support and a drop in community, because beforehand there were, you know, people who came to our groups and they would come to Compass, you know, three nights a week. So it was a big part of their life, and seeing their friends and seeing the people that they that work at Compass and, you know, are supportive and mentors to them almost. So it was a big shift to do. And so the biggest struggle was trying to recreate that in a virtual setting. But we also use some different streaming platforms to host movie nights. But for the most part, we're using a lot of Zoom and Discord so that we can have a sense of community virtually.
Yeah, I just did a queer movie night with my friends. We watched But I'm a Cheerleader, classic movie. It's amazing. But moving on, we see when you talk about like this drop in community, how that impacts the mental health of LGBTQ plus youth. So how has COVID-19 impacted the mental health of like LGBTQ plus youth specifically?
You know, it's, we talk about adverse childhood experiences and ACEs, and the way you combat ACEs is by having those positive adults, positive role models. Those may be your parents, it may not be your parents. And for a lot of our youth, Compass is that positive place for them. So not being able to access it, that Compass might be the only place where they are able to come dressed the way they want to come, or be referred to the name and pronouns that they are, you know, the most in line with themselves with. So getting that taken away was devastating. It was something that no one was expecting, and it happened so sudden that it really made an acute need for a lot of support and a lot of use of coping skills in the beginning, which was why it was really helpful that we had our therapy services, because everyone was learning for the first time, how do we do anything in a pandemic? So, and let alone a young person who was just planning on going to school every day and doing the things that they do with their friends. And then now it's like, no, you don't get to go to school. No, you don't get to go to prom. No, you're not doing graduation. You're not doing all these fun things that you've been looking forward to. So it was a really big shift in their mindset, and then us trying to support them and where they're at now so that we can make it as, you know, nice as possible. You know, it's not perfect by any means, but I think we have been able to be supportive and provide a space for people to come together, that we've been able to get kids to come in from Chicago, Colorado, Texas, all different states because of having an online presence. So there is that positive part of being online now, but it's definitely not the same and everyone's feeling it and missing that connection. So we're looking forward to when we finally can be together again in person.
Right. So when you talk about how if they need to get to the center, like in person, they need an adult who they can trust. Maybe it's a parent or maybe it's a sibling. And what that kind of reminds me of is how a lot of these like queer kids don't really have that supportive environment at home. And now they're isolated with them 24/7. These parents might not use the right pronouns for them or do other kind of invalidating behavior of their identity. So what's the impact of that? And have you seen that like among the kids that you work with?
Definitely. It's been a really extreme impact on their mental health, on their sense of self. It's been something where, you know, school and Compass might have been the places where they felt most comfortable because they were able to have, you know, teachers say their name and their pronouns and Compass as well. And especially Compass is a safe place for people to explore because there is that portion of questioning and trying things out and not wanting to share that until you really know what it feels right for you. And that's been taken away. So being at home, and especially if you have unsupportive family members, you're going to have a lot more distress because you are not feeling, you know, comfortable and safe in your environment. And there's no relief outside because we're all stuck at home. It has been a really big portion of what our young people have experienced and have shared in our therapy group and in individual sessions, because they are having a really hard time coping at being at home all the time if they are having unsupportive families. It really does take a toll on your own mental health and the way you feel about yourself.
This is Saria Reimer, WLRN intern. I'm speaking with Amanda Canetti, Youth Program Director at the Compass LGBTQ+ Community Center. We're discussing the impact of the pandemic on the mental health of queer people. So as a queer person myself, I can definitely relate to how like irritating it is and sort of condescending when my own identity is invalidated. And I know there's probably plenty of kids around South Florida who are maybe listening right now who are going through the same thing. So I was wondering if you had any advice on how queer kids can cope with that in a way that is healthy.
Yeah, so definitely I think reaching out to queer organizations that are going to support you for who you are. So Compass, whether it's national organizations, finding the people that are going to support and uplift you for who you are is going to really give you that sense of validation and support that everyone needs, especially if you're a young queer person. So contact and Compass, you know, we have a ton of services that people are able to access. And also just, you know, finding your sense of community or talking to a trusted friend or an adult and looking for some healthy coping skills, or even just, you know, sharing what's going on. Sometimes there is no solution, but having someone be able to hear you and empathize and, you know, say that stinks that that's happening. We want to be able to find those ways that we can connect right now because we're all missing that.
So you mentioned the service that you guys offer at Compass relating to mental health. So you guys have provided over 6,400 counseling hours. I found it on the website. So around how much of it is at no cost to the LGBT+ people who need it?
Perfect. So that definitely includes our adult services. So I actually did the numbers for last year for our only specifically our youth services. And last year we did 52 group therapy sessions in the year, and we provided 526 individual sessions last year, and all of that was no cost to families. So we definitely are trying to do our part and making sure that mental health services is accessible to anyone. It shouldn't be only for people who can afford it.
Right. So going back to what you just said, I found in my own experience when I have to explain to my therapist like what my lesbian identity means to me and how that sort of relates to how I carry myself and how I view myself, I was wondering if you could elaborate on like the importance of having a queer affirming mental health professional and like what that means for these kids.
Yes, it's very important. No one should have to feel that they have to educate the person that they're going to see who is the expert. So we want to make sure that whoever you're seeing has that general knowledge, that understands when you're using terminology, they understand what that means. They understand the reason why pronouns are so important. They're able to express your feelings and to family members. If they're not understanding, it's really, really important to have affirming therapists, because, you know, there's the opposite end where there are therapists, I don't know if I'd call them therapists, that are unaffirming and are trying to change someone, which we know that does not work. So finding someone who is affirming and just helping you with whether it is struggling with your identity or your sexuality or just normal teenager things. You want to make sure that you can bring your full self to a group or to a session. And if you are unsure if they're accepting, you're going to hold back. You're not going to share everything that's going on in your life, and you shouldn't have to educate the person you're seeing. There's plenty of information out there for people to get educated. And Compass, it has a mental health collaborative that is specifically focused on educating other mental health providers so that they're able to serve LGBTQ youth and adults in a way that is affirming, accepting, and, you know, validating of their identity.
You referenced conversion therapy really quickly there. I was just wondering, have you worked with any young people who have went through something similar to gay conversion therapy? Because there's another push in the legislature to end the practice, even though it should be noted that that push is strictly for physical conversion therapy as opposed to like the talk therapy that's more common.
Yeah, so from our young people, I can't off the top of my head recall someone who has disclosed it. There are people that are on staff at Compass that are queer people that have undergone conversion therapy. And anecdotally, we know of others who have had to go through that experience, but luckily the youth that we're working with, no one has mentioned that. But, you know, I also understand that the kids that we're seeing, as difficult as their experience might be, there's also all the kids that we aren't getting because they can't even get to Compass, or it's so much of a burden that they have nowhere safe to even be able to access us online, that those are the kids that, you know, might be really, really struggling.
Right. Yeah. Do you guys have that sort of outreach that relates to people from different cultures in terms of like different languages or the kind of cultural barriers that come with understanding queer people?
Yeah. So it's definitely something that we are really focused on and starting to have those services in different areas, but we always can do more. So currently right now we have, when we were meeting in person, there is a PFLAG meeting that is hosted in Spanish, which is a parents and family group. Right now, the person who facilitates those, she's really elderly. She's super sweet, but she's not really on Zoom. So she's doing more like phone calls with everyone. So when we can have that in person, those would continue again. We also do have a therapist that is Spanish speaking who sees clients. So that is available to anyone seeking mental health services. We provide case management for people living with HIV and AIDS in Spanish, English, and Haitian Creole. But for youth groups, we currently do not have one that is in Spanish or Haitian Creole. So that is something where we would love to expand to. There's only two of us in the youth department right now, so we're trying our best. But it's definitely something of Compass's, you know, 3-year, 5-year plan where we do want to expand services in other languages. Another thing that would be not from Compass, but something that any student or any young person could access is called QChat. And QChat is run by YouthLink, which is a portion of CenterLink. And they provide text-based LGBTQ youth groups to youth all across the country. So it's predominantly for kids who can't reach a place like Compass, and it's all online based, and they have it in Spanish and English. And it's something that anyone, it's free to attend, and they have a bunch of them throughout the week. So it's easier for people to join.
That was WLRN's high school intern, Saria Reimer, speaking with Amanda Canetti. She's the Youth Program Director at the Compass LGBTQ Plus Community Center. And if you or someone you know is considering suicide, please, help is available all the time at the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. That's 800-273-8255. Well, keeping on the issue of mental health, we're going to end today's program with a new sculpture exhibition that explores the topic. Sculptor Dominic Esposito focuses his artwork on current events. His latest exhibition, Blank Slate, opens in West Palm Beach this week. It explores the stories behind our mental health and hopes to combat the stigma behind seeking help. Dominic joins us now. Dominic, thank you so much for the time.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
You gained national attention for a sculpture that you placed. It was an 800-pound sculpture of a spoon being used for cooking heroin. It was placed outside of the Sackler's offices in Connecticut. And for those unfamiliar, that's the family that was behind Purdue Pharma, which has faced multiple lawsuits for their role in proliferating opioid prescriptions. You did it because this issue has something resonates with you personally because of your brother.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, we placed this large 800-pound burnt opioid spoon in front of Purdue Sackler. It's in the reason and the sort of inspiration behind it is just my brother Danny. So he's still alive. As a family, we've dealt with substance use disorder for the last I'd say 12 years now. It's a battle that is it's got a lot of ups and downs. It's really a journey It really was a sort of overall frustration that I was feeling with the sort of the system as a whole. Here you have these corporate criminals effectively getting away with murder. This is a man-made epidemic, the opioid crisis, and we've lived with this in this country for the last 20 years. And it was really a way to kind of shine a spotlight on the pharmaceutical industry. And subsequently, we've done other protests since then with other large sculptures.
Yeah. With that sculpture, what was the response from the Sackler family?
So, they put out basically their kind of, the corporate attorney is just basically a release saying, we recognize that, people are allowed to protest and, we're sorry for the victims and that was it. And that was, that was 3 years ago. That was the first time we did it. It was June of 2018. We also demonstrated in front of another one of their buildings, which is the Rhodes Pharmaceutical, which is a subsidiary of the Purdue Sackler family. And it's a generic brand manufacturer of opioids down in Coventry, Rhode Island. So yeah. We sort of kept at it. And so after that, we did another one in April of 2019, and that one was really kind of call attention to the government, really, so the FDA. We brought a large spoon down to the FDA in Washington, D.C., the Health and Human Services building, really to kind of call them out for, one, allowing all these opioids to kind of so easily get into society, and also, they've been approving stronger and stronger doses. Now you can have it available for kids under 11. So all that got approved. Here we have this crisis, all these people dying, and all the addiction that's happening in this country. And they increase the proliferation of it over the last few years.
Yeah. I wanted to, bring this back to your new, work. And again, coming here to South Florida, so much attention has been placed on the burden of COVID on our health, as well as our mental health. We keep talking about vaccine distribution, medication for treatment, accessing to tests. But why was mental health, that aspect of the pandemic, important for you in your focus and this work now?
Yeah, so it's really just a natural progression of the work. Mental health is such a big component of substance use disorder, and it's really difficult to even analyze. Does one cause the others? Is substance use versus what causes one? I'm not a doctor, obviously. I'm an artist, right? But for me, it was really important to highlight just how victimized that COVID has left people dealing with both substance use disorder and on top of that, a mental health. And it's the isolation, it's the loneliness. It's those components that have really exacerbated the crisis, right? So you have this hidden crisis within a pandemic, right? And it's gotten much worse, right? You've seen deaths escalate, especially down here in southern Florida. you know, United States alone, I think we saw something like 81,000 deaths from opioids overdoses in 2020. You know, that's up from, you know, 72,000. So definitely an increase. And you're seeing it just, you know, anecdotally, I'm seeing it day in, day out. Right? Well, our supporters, our followers, people in recovery that I know that I've come across, all suffering. It's this isolationism. I know, you know, you can make the argument of the telehealth and all the other, you know, the Zoom calls, but it's just not the same to be in a group environment and to have someone to talk to listen to you.
Right. I wanted to ask you about one of the pieces. This one stood out for me. It's you have one of a faceless person in a large black hoodie. Their arms are in their pockets. They're looking down. I first thing I was thinking of was the Grim Reaper. What's the story behind this piece?
Yeah, so is this the one with the burnt, Sienna, the burnt red background, is that right?
Yeah.
The darker hoodie. There's three of them in that series. Each one of them has a different sort of meaning for me as an artist. But that one in particular, the title of that piece is called The Saleable. And it sort of speaks to how vulnerable people are and just the sort of the stance of that hoodie in itself. Looking down, the clothing become part of the language that you see, right? And at times, you know, you know, I always see it with, you know, people. You know, sometimes they have their, you know, they have their head down, and there's obvious, and wearing the hoodie has kind of encapsulated substance use disorder, mental health, I think, in this country as a clothing and the way you wear it, and that's really what I wanted to show in that piece. And the weight of it, it's actually made in bronze. So there's this big, if you think of it as like this bronze, it's hard to describe to people listening, but it's this bronze sculpture that stands out from this painted background, right? So you have both the 2D of the painting, but then you have this 3D effect of this heavy bronze sculpture, pointing just to the heaviness of the subject matter that we're talking about.
Right.
Have you gotten a chance to see some of the other ones?
Well, you know what? I was curious about the choice of using a hoodie, you know, and you kind of just touched on a little bit. I mean, you know, we were talking about not too long ago about a piece over here at the Low Art Museum, and it was a giant hoodie. You know, we're talking about Trayvon Martin's story, but something about the hoodie, and I'm wondering what, for you, why it was the appropriate piece of clothing to use.
Yeah, the artists, we sort of love to sort of, it's always a way for us to have our heart on our sleeves. That's what they say about us. And I've seen it personally with, you know, my own kids. You know, I see them, you know, one of them, they've got their hoodie on over their head, and I'm like, you know, I approach them gently to subtly figure out what's going on or try to help if I can. I've seen it with my brother, and a lot of the people that I come across during this journey, you know, battling for the opioid crisis, you know, this hoodie has become emblematic of how they feel at times, right? And that's really what, to me personally, what it encapsulates, the people around me, the people I've met. Yes, you know, there was, the Trayvon Martin and all what happened, you know, 8 or 9 years ago, I believe. But I think since then we've actually seen a lot more of it, and it's art, right? So it's up to people's interpretation of what they see in it and how it's portrayed.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about this to finish up. Is I'm noticing online, just in different places, you know, social media and so forth, more ads for mental health services, and it seems like maybe, you know, getting therapy, getting help, has kind of become, it's, you know, part of the mainstream psyche, like, you know, that it's okay to reach out and get help. And I know that, you know, there's a stigma that you're trying to, you know, with your art, you're also trying to battle.
That's right. It's, yes, you're 100% right. There's a lot more of it out there. I think what we don't grasp is that how, first of all, it's difficult to get help without paying for it, right? That's the part. And yes, you can get some help, and there's laws that are in place that are just not being enforced in this country. There's a 2008, I don't want to get super technical on the legislative actions, but there's a 2008 called Mental Health Parity Law.
Yeah.
And that is not being enforced across the board at different state levels, right? So, so we want to be able to enforce those laws. In fact, I worked closely on a commission during the for the Biden re-election campaign that dealt with enforcing those laws at a national level. This is for 100-day actions and on a committee there. And it looks like, you know, we're going to get hopefully some of that work through. Former Congressman Kennedy has worked very hard on this specific issue of mental health parity and how insurance companies have sort of basically gotten away with it. So the help is out there. I would advise people to seek that help if it's, you know, if it's readily available, and then kind of know what your laws are and try to get paid help, right?
Yeah, no, definitely. Lots of good points there to hit. Dominic Esposito, again, his exhibition is coming out in West Palm Beach. It's called A Blank Slate. We've got some photos, by the way. It's open to the public. It starts again this weekend. Go to our social media, WLRN Sundial, to learn more. Dominic, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me.
And that is our program for this Thursday, March 4th. Well, coming up next week on the program, we're going to take a look at COVID immunity. A new study finds those who've contracted the virus and those who've gotten the vaccine have relatively similar immunity. We're going to explore the research and we'll take your questions about the vaccine. Plus, farm workers in South Florida played a critical role in raising wages for folks in agriculture across the country. An investigation from the Palm Beach Post explores how migrant workers led the battle. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a great Friday.